the Pharisees were very religious, and Jesus was very popular. One day, one of the Pharisees, after hearing a sermon by Jesus, invited Jesus to his home for dinner. It started out to be quite an ordinary event. Jesus, in typical Mideastern fashion, reclined by the table, had his left hand holding up his head, his right hand there, ready to eat. And the host was just shocked, surprised, amazed, because Jesus had not washed his hands before the meal. Now, that doesn't mean to him the same thing that it means to us. For us, washing hands before a meal is mostly about cleanliness. For those people then, it was mostly about religion. It was one of the many rules which regulated even the most routine and minute activities of life. You see, religious people always washed their hands before every meal. And if you didn't, that showed everyone that you are irreligious and sinful. All of which goes beyond the Bible. There was nothing in the Bible that said one way or the other that it is good or bad to wash hands before eating, but they had a tradition, and the tradition had been raised to be of equal authority and value with the Bible. But understand, they weren't talking about a quick wash and dry wipe of the hands. They had it all prescribed, not only before the meal, but before every course of the meal. Not with ordinary water, but special water, extra clean, in large pots that were kept around all places for eating. And the details of how it needed to be done. For example, you couldn't get by with just a few drops. It was regulated that you had to use at least the amount of water that would fill 1 1/2 eggshells. And you had to start by pouring the water from fingertips on down to the wrist, both hands, and then make a fist in the opposite hand and rub it in the palm of each hand. And then after doing that, to rinse them again with at least 1 1/2 eggshells of water, this time rinsing from the wrist down to the fingertips. And omitting the slightest detail was considered to be sin. So imagine Jesus coming into this man's house with these traditions, seeing the meal spread on the table and saying, "Hey, looks good, let's eat," and grabs the food and starts eating. And this Pharisee is totally offended that Jesus has not washed his hands the way he was supposed to. Now, before we call them silly and crown ourselves as superior, let's make some comparisons. For example, the majority of Americans know that the Bible says that cleanliness is next to godliness. They don't know exactly where it says that in the Bible, but they're sure it's in there somewhere, and if you look long enough, you're probably going to find it. The fact is, the Bible does not say that. That's a tradition. It's sort of crept into our culture, and we believe it. Cleanliness is next to godliness, because that's what we've always been told. It's a story about an American researcher who was visiting a Scandinavian community and went into this lovely church building and observed that the people, when they would walk in, came down the center aisle, came to a space between the pews next to a blank white wall, would turn and genuflect, and then go back down the aisle. So he asked the people why they did that. No one knew. No one. So he asked the pastor of the church, who also didn't know. So he talked to people within the community, old-timers who had been there for a long time, said, everyone did it. No one had any idea why anyone did it. So he pursued his research and became something of a detective and discovered that that church building prior to the Reformation had been a Roman Catholic church building, and that there was there on the wall hundreds of years before a painting of the Virgin Mary, and the practice was to come in and to genuflect before that painting. However, in the 16th century, when it became a Lutheran church building, it was painted over, so you could no longer see the painting at all. But for hundreds of years, everyone, passing it down from generation to generation, stopped and turned to a blank wall and genuflected there because that was the tradition of the way it was supposed to be done. The point being that the physical tradition continued long after the reason for it was gone. And we do that. We all have our traditions. We have our liturgies, those which go far beyond the Bible. That liturgy may include certain hymns and types of hymns, certain prayers and processionals and clothing and creeds and responses. There are commitments to styles of music that say this is the way, the right and only way to worship God, to certain versions of the Bible, that it has to be that version and no other version, that worship of God has to be at a certain time of day. There has to be a certain style of preaching. There are those who would say that if there aren't at least 2 minutes of shouting, it is not really a sermon. You need a little bit of shouting to qualify for it to be a sermon. That prayers have to be read out of a book, or they're not prayers. Or some would say, if they are read out of a book, they're not prayers. Or that there has to be a cross in the church building, or there has to always be communion at every gathering, or that the leader up front has to be officially ordained according to all of the rules of the denomination. Traditions. They're all traditions. And the list goes on. And I think to myself sometimes that if Jesus were here, perhaps he would come and shake us up, and he would clap when we are supposed to be silent, or silent when we are supposed to clap, that he would stand when everyone else is seated, or that he would sit when everyone else is standing, so that he might break the rituals to remind us that even the best of traditions can become meaningless. Now, this Pharisee, who was so steeped in tradition, thought that he had nailed Jesus. He thought that he had caught Jesus in a sin. And he did what many people do when catching other people in sins. He felt himself to be superior. But he never imagined what Jesus would do. Turning it around, Jesus confronted him. He nailed the Pharisee. He said, "Now then, you Pharisees, you clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people. Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will be clean for you." In other words, Jesus was confronting him and saying, "Hey, Pharisee, you have a serious problem. You're clean on the outside, or at least you so think, but you are really dirty on the inside. You're so proud that you're all scrubbed up, that your hands, that your fingernails, that everything is squeaky clean. But inside, your soul is filthy. So you look good. Yeah, you look good by external appearances. But inside, you're caked with greed and with wickedness. And what good is this so-called cleanliness if inside you're rotten? Don't you know that the God who made us not only made the outside, but the inside? Don't you know that the God who created us can see inside of our souls? So why don't you change the way you are on the inside, like caring about and giving to the poor, instead of putting all of your energy and resources into washing your hands on the outside?" When our children were young, we bought this really good-looking, used, blue Ford station wagon. It was so good-looking that even though it was used, it looked like it was brand new. The trouble was, the engine was a filthy wreck in this thing. I don't really know, but my theory is that the previous owner never changed the oil, never changed a filter, and drove 90% of the miles through dust storms. I can't explain the way the car behaved without something like that. How bad was it? Well, we took it on a long trip once that included driving from New York City to Denver, and the car broke down every 2 to 5 miles. That is not funny. That is not. You try that. That means it broke down over 400 times in 2,000 miles from New York to Denver. And you say, "Why didn't you get it fixed?" Come on, I'm not that stupid. I went to a dozen Ford dealerships in, I think, every state from New York to Colorado. I was told to replace the engine, replace the gas tank, to replace the fuel lines, spent too much money in the process. None of them were able to fix it. I think this was the last Ford that we owned, in fact, in our family. It was finally here in Richfield that one day this car enormously overheated. And had to be fixed. It cost almost $1,000 to get the engine fixed. And 3 days later, it overheated again. And finally, I decided it was time to trade it in. And it looked good. I mean, it was a great car to trade in. I mean, it just looked brand new. Oh, I hope you didn't buy it. I hope you did not buy that car. It looked so good on the outside, and it was so clogged up and dirty on the inside. Now, according to Jesus, this principle is even more important when it comes to people, that looking good on the outside, sure, it's nice, but that's not what's important. What really matters is the soul. And he's saying that if these Pharisees had spent as much time and energy on getting their souls clean as their hands clean, they would have been much better men. Now, what Jesus did next needs to be understood in context. He lays on this Pharisee six woes. And, you know, that seems kind of intense, kind of heavy. But understand what Jesus was doing. Out of love and compassion, he was pointing out the dirt on the soul of this man, the faults that needed to be fixed. I suppose that you could say that it would be like taking your car into a dealership and having an analysis done. And the mechanic is looking at the list and says, oh, yeah, oh, no. Oh, wow. Ooh, I haven't seen that for a long time. Oh. And then, oh, wow, we need to sit down and talk. And Jesus is saying, not a curse upon these people. He's saying, there's another one. So let's look at the list. But as we do, could we pretend that Jesus is not just studying the soul of the Pharisee, but he's studying our souls as well? First on his list is dirt number one, which is greed disguised to look like generosity. Jesus said, woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. You see, these Pharisees were absolutely legalistic about the money that they gave to God. They gave a tithe, or 10% to God, and they were proud of it. But they went further, actually beyond any requirement of their law, and they would take herbs from their garden, and they'd count out the seeds and take 10% and give that to God. Or they'd weigh the produce from their garden and always donate 10%. I suppose that would be equivalent today to someone getting a paycheck, writing a check to the church for exactly 10% of whatever that amount of money is, but then also turning around and counting every flower in your garden and bringing 10% of the flowers to church on Sunday morning, or counting all the cucumbers, bringing a tenth of them, or weighing all the tomatoes and bringing a tenth of the tomatoes and giving them to God. Now, I want you to notice something interesting here. This is the only time that we have any record of Jesus ever saying anything about a tithe. It is the only reference to a tithe in the entire New Testament. And Jesus commended them. He said, good thing. You did the right thing. That's good. But he also condemned them for neglecting justice and the love of God. They were proud on the outside of what they were giving, and at the same time, their souls were dirty. Dirty with greed, and dirty with injustice, and dirty with a lack of love for God. What they needed to do was to be generous on the outside. Sure, that's a good thing to do, but also to be gracious and generous and loving and kind on the inside. Now, I will tell you out of a lifetime of experience that I've come to a personal conclusion that there is no such thing as a committed Christian who does not give. It just isn't. However, there are some people who can fake it, and that's what Jesus is talking about. It's possible to fake generosity on the outside while being greedy on the inside. Jesus is saying that that is dirt on the soul. Dirt number two on Jesus' list is the love of recognition. This time he said, woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogue and greetings in the marketplace. This time Jesus criticized them for seeking attention. In public, they always pushed to the most prominent place. They liked to be seen by other people. They wanted other people to know who they were. This is the kind of person who walks in front of a group of people and is extremely self-conscious. How do I look? What do people think? What's their view of me? Are all eyes on me instead of being other-directed? So this is someone who is selfish, self-centered, full of oneself instead of full of love and recognition and honoring of others. Jesus says this love of being recognized is dirt on the soul. Dirt number three is being dangerous to other people. Now, this one's a little bit harder to understand because of the cultural and time difference between us now and the time in which this took place. So it takes a little bit of explaining. But first, what Jesus said. Woe to you because you are like unmarked graves, which men walk over without knowing it. Now, under the Old Testament law, if someone touched a body or stepped on a grave, that person was technically and temporarily disqualified from participating in the public worship of God in the temple in Jerusalem. Jesus is saying that in those days, people were very careful then to mark their graves. So there were stones or other markers so that you wouldn't accidentally step on a grave. In fact, they went so far as to whitewash graves. So if you're walking through the countryside, they were painted white. But he's saying to these Pharisees, you guys are like unmarked graves. So people come along, they think that you're fine, but they don't know it, and they step on you, they rub up against you, and you contaminate them. They're contaminated by their contact with you because under the surface, you're so dirty in your soul, so sinful in who you are, and so contaminating of other people. And that they would never expect it. There are people like that today. There are people, you look at them, they seem fine. They ought to wear markers. They ought to wear signs that say, keep away. These are people who have critical spirits, who have unkind hearts, who are just filled with anger and hostility, who are sort of oozing an inside sinfulness that is almost like a contagious flesh-eating bacteria. And sometimes they don't even see this about themselves. They don't even realize what they are doing to other people. Jesus is saying that's a dirt on the soul. Dirt number four is similar to dirt number three. Jesus said in Luke 11:46, you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. Now, this dirt is especially common among religious leaders and teachers who make religion as tough as they can. These are people who, when they teach the Bible and they explain how to live a righteous life, in fact, just pile up expectations and burdens until eventually the listener says, I can't do it. I came for hope and I've got nothing but discouragement. I'm ready to crumble under all of the things, all the rules and regulations, the laws that you've laid on me. Then Jesus said, to make it even worse, these religious leaders, once they've burdened people down, sort of say, ha, tough on you, and aren't willing to lift a single finger to help them reach the expectations that they, the leaders, have put upon them. And Jesus is again saying, this is a dirt on the soul. That the problem isn't so much with the child, but with the parent. Not so much with the student as with the teacher. That their souls are dirty and need to be scrubbed down and filled instead with love, with grace, and with helpfulness. That they were actually rejecting. Jesus uses an interesting approach here. What he says is that God has sent all kinds of prophets for all time. In English, it would be from A to Z, from Abel to Zechariah. You know what happened every time they gave the message of God? Your forefathers, your ancestors, rejected them and killed them. Now you're saying, oh, we wouldn't have done that. We build monuments to them. We build tombs to honor them. We believe in what they had to say. Jesus said, you know, that's not true. It's not true because you don't do what those earlier prophets said, and you're following the same pattern as your ancestors because you're rejecting me, and I'm the last and the greatest of God's prophets. I don't know how you'd compare that to today. I suppose it would be like somebody saying, oh, the most important days of the year for me are Abraham Lincoln's birthday and Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Oh, I just think it's wonderful. I have monuments to both of them out in my backyard. But that person totally disregards the teaching and the influence of those two famous American leaders. So it's saying one thing and doing another thing. I suppose it would be like somebody saying, oh, I love the Bible. The Bible's just great. I have 7 Bibles. I have a Bible when you come into my house. I have a Bible in the bedroom. I have a Bible in the car. I have a baby Bible that I keep inside my pocket. I have all of these different Bibles. I just love and respect and honor the Bible. And then that person never reads it, never obeys it, doesn't make any practical difference in life. In fact, it's rejected. They pretended to honor God's prophets, but they rejected the teaching of those prophets. And he said, that's the mark of a dirty soul. Dirt number 6 is the last in Jesus' list. It finishes the list, but there are some ways in which it was the dirtiest dirt of the entire pile. It was the dirt of hindering God's truth. Jesus said, woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering. Jesus accused these Pharisees of making the Bible inaccessible to ordinary people. What they were doing was saying, we have the education. We've studied the Holy Scriptures. We can explain it and we can interpret it in a way that ordinary people could never begin to understand. And Jesus was saying, what you've in fact done is you've made it so complicated. You've made it so hard. You've made God's truth so inaccessible that the Bible has ended up becoming nonsense to people. They can't even begin to figure it out. They figure that you have to go to school for a lifetime before you can understand a single thing that the Bible has to say. And then he's saying, worst of all, you guys did go to school for a lifetime and you still don't understand it. You're worse off than you were when you first got started. That problem has been repeated. Do you know that for centuries there were churches that abided by civil law and influenced civil law, forbidding that the Bible be translated into the ordinary language of the people? So the only way that people could read the Bible is they had to go to school for decades, which wasn't at that time even possible, and they had to learn Hebrew, or they had to learn Greek, or most often they had to learn Latin. And if they couldn't, then they had to depend upon those who had to explain the Bible. The difficulty was that then those who explained the Bible would choose which parts they would teach and which parts they would exclude. They'd put their own interpretations and spins upon it, until eventually the Bible became total nonsense. You couldn't see it, you couldn't read it, you couldn't understand it. All these contradictory teachings and explanations, until it was simply impossible. And it wasn't until a revolution, a reformation came along, that the Bible came into the languages of ordinary people like ourselves. So that today we can read and understand the Bible and it is accessible to us. And what about people like me? Well, I would say that there may be a little bit of value, not much, for people like me. Those who have given lots of years and gone to lots of schools and read lots of books. But I would warn you. I would warn you not to depend upon me or depend upon anybody else, that you read the Bible for yourself. And that you not let anyone ever tell you, don't let anyone ever tell you, that God's truth can only be understood by those who are religious experts, because it is not true. Woe to those who insist that they are the only ones with the key to God's truth. They have dirt on their souls. Now, the story of dirt and confrontation ends with the responses of the Pharisees. And they had the same response that anyone has whenever a person is confronted and told what is wrong. You can either listen and take the challenge and do something about it, or get defensive and reject the messenger as well as the criticism. So here's what they did. When Jesus left there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. Jesus tried to help them, and they turned against him. If Jesus were to examine my soul, what would he see? What would be the list of woes that he would point out? What would be the dirt that he would expose? If Jesus were to examine your soul, what would he see? It could be in his examination of your soul and mine that he might list one of the six from this chapter of his biography, but it could well be that our souls are dirty with other problems and other sins that never even made that first list. But there is a sense in which even more important is, how do we respond? Do we get defensive? Do we say, oh, you know, I don't want to know, I don't want to see it, or who do you think you are telling me what's wrong with me? Or do we welcome Jesus, who with love and compassion and for our best interests exposes the dirt on our souls with every expectation that he will be there for us, that he will cleanse us from every unrighteousness, that he will make us pure, clean us out. Because the inside is more important than the outside. Because Jesus Christ wants us not primarily to have clean hands, but to have clean hearts and clean souls. Lord Jesus, thank you for caring enough to tell us what we might not otherwise want to hear. May we hear what you have to say. May your Spirit speak directly to our souls and consciences. May we see the dirt within us. And may we respond readily, confessing to you our sin, asking for your forgiveness, and inviting you to hose us down from the inside out, that we may be holy and just and good and all that you want us to be. We pray in your name. Amen.